tell me, sir, about the process that's changed in the new 5000.02 and how it's different from the old.
It's interesting. The basic process that one has to go through to develop any product and field that is pretty much a constant. I've seen about a dozen different versions of 5002 in my career, and they essentially all do the same thing in slightly different ways. What I tried to do in this version was make it clear that there are a number of ways you should structure an acquisition program's life cycle, depending upon what the product is that you're acquiring and a number of factors that influence how you want to go about that. So I've provided a number of different models that are product related, whether it's a software intensive product or a hardware intensive product, for example, and also one for rapid acquisition, where urgency of the need is the driving factor in how you structure the program. The idea is to make it clear to people that they should start with careful thought about the job that has to be done, and then lay out the program consistent with that job and the nature of the product, which is a bit of a deviation from past versions, which had one model that people tried to force their programs into, basically.
You said that this is going to give the department a better implementation for the Better Buying Power initiative. How is that? What about BP Better Buying Power will be easier to implement because of this?
Let me just mention a couple of examples. One is an emphasis on the use of affordability analysis, which is part of Better Buying Power. There's a section in 5002, an enclosure, that deals with how to do that kind of analysis and what it is. Essentially, this is long-term capital planning, where people have to assess whether future budgets will support a product or not, and what level of funding, what cost they're going to be able to bear as they get into production and sustainment. So we're implementing that Better Buying Power guidance very directly in 5002. Another is the use of should cost, the idea that our program managers have to look at their cost structures very carefully, understand where there's opportunity to reduce cost, set up targets to achieve those reductions, and then go after them and try to achieve them. The other thing I'll mention is the relationship between requirements and acquisition, trying to strengthen that relationship. And we've added a decision point into the process from previous versions where the requirements are defined then are used to guide the rest of the development. That was missing from the previous iteration. And we've also emphasized the use of configuration steering boards, which are really boards of both acquirers and requirers that have to meet together to look at priorities and do cost trade-offs and make smart decisions about what features to have in a product. So there are a number of ways in which Better Buying Power is kind of infused into this version of 5002.
A couple of points about those elements, Mr. Kendall. You talked about should cost, and I've had extensive conversations with Beth McGrath before she left DOD about the cost culture concept. Is that an element of what you're getting at here? Is this just another opportunity to try to reinforce that throughout the acquisition structure?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of what we're trying to accomplish with Better Buying Power is about making all of our managers more cost conscious and getting them to understand that it is a fundamental responsibility to control cost and not just to spend your budget. The business board that advises the DOD has talked about this, that we tend to have in government in general a culture of spending where the mission is interpreted as being to spend the budget every year. And we reinforce that because we do execution reviews to see if people are spending to the expected, profiles. I want people to take their time to get good business deals. I want them to try to come in below their budget whenever they can, and I want to reward people for that. So that is a cultural change, and it's one I think we're making progress on, but we probably still have a ways to go on.
Now, that's a concept that's been around for a while, and your predecessor, Jack Gansler, talks about it with the JDAM missile example, mm-hmm. where the goal was it was supposed to do this, it was supposed to cost this much, and we were supposed to be able to buy this many copies. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like between the time that he wanted to implement that and where you are today, the idea of how much they were supposed to cost and you were supposed to be able to get this many copies kind of got lost in the shuffle. Is that what you want to try to do here to bring that idea back into the mix at the very beginning?
That's certainly part of it. I think we went through an era, particularly with where funds flowed relatively freely to the department. And that's understandable during the period of, you know, conflict where budgets were quite a bit higher. We had large overseas contingency operations accounts to work with. I think we got a little bit, I'll say complacent maybe, about controlling costs the way we should be and didn't emphasize that nearly as much as we should be. But I go back a long ways in the Defense Department, and I think there's always been this sense that you were going to be punished if you didn't spend all of your money. We want people to feel that if they don't spend all their money, if they, you know, divert it to higher, you know, priorities for the department or for the service, or even if they return funds to the Treasury, that that's a positive thing. We have not done that, I think, historically.
Would you like to put incentives in place, or are you putting incentives in place to encourage that, not just to say this is a good idea, but to help people to change their behaviors, to have them go about actually doing that?
That's an important point, because the whole chain of command has to support this, or it's not going to work. And so we're trying to reward people professionally, trying to recognize this. You know, the awards that we give out each year now are really emphasizing cost control predominantly. So recognition, professional advancement, things like that are things that we can do. We have limited capability to give people financial incentives in government. But we are also trying very hard to create incentives for industry to be more cost effective in what they do. And that's done through our contracting medium.
I'd like to talk about the law part of this. How have changes in the law, you've alluded to the changes that have happened since Goldwater Nichols, how have those changes affected the acquisition workforce and their ability to do some of these things? You've said that you would like to kind of clear some of that confusion and some of the legal issues up there.
Yeah, the as I was building 5002, this version, it became clear to me that we had built up a very large and complicated and sometimes overlapping and occasionally even contradictory body of law governing all the different kinds of programs that we acquire. Laws that govern information technology, business systems, urgent needs, you know, the basic weapon systems laws, et cetera, automated information systems. There's a long list of categories, and each of them has its own set of rules. And it had gotten extremely complicated. There's an enclosure in 5002 which lays all this out in tables, and they go on for page after page after page. So we've created a big burden for our program managers, and I'd like to simplify that. Now, that said, there are a lot of good things that have been done with the laws that have been added after Goldwater Nichols. The Weapon System Acquisition System Reform Act, I think, did a lot of good. Some of the things that was originally called the Improve Act, I think, did a lot of good. But we need to kind of clean up the underbrush, if you will, make this a more coherent body of law, make it easier to implement, and simplify the lives of our program managers so they can focus on what they really need to be doing.
You talked about accountability earlier in our conversation, sir, and one of the goals that you've said that you wanted to get at here was to reinforce the acquisition chain of command. Tell me how you want to do that, and tell me exactly the message that you want people at all stages of the acquisition chain of command to understand.
We tend to be, and some of the legislation does this, we tend to try to improve our performance by inspecting in quality, is the way I would put it, as opposed to designing it in. That's an old management aphorism, that the right way to get quality is by designing it in as opposed to trying to inspect it in later. It's a lot more cost-effective if you do it right. So that's sort of what's behind this. I want the chain of command, which is fundamentally responsible for bringing programs in, delivering products, to have the accountability and the responsibility and the authority they need to do that. And I want those people to be supported and recognized. I think acquisition, program management, is very analogous to running a business or to commanding a unit. Leadership matters, and the capabilities of the chain of command, their professionalism, really more than anything else, affects results. So I'm emphasizing that, and I'm trying to get us away from a point where, or a situation where, staff supervision, in particular, substitutes for chain of command responsibility. And I found, after having been out of government for about 15 years and then coming back, that we had moved much more towards a staff supervision model than a chain of command model. And that's what I'm trying to get us back to. And the first few decision memorandums that I looked at when I got back, that the Undersecretary puts out on program decision milestones, have these long, long list of tasks for the program managers to come back and give briefings and reports and so on to staff people. And I have done everything I could to cut that out. The staff is not in charge of the program. It's not managing the program. The program manager is, program executive officer and service acquisition executive are. And I want those people to be focused on doing their jobs. Once we, at my level, have approved a plan for a program and made sure that it's sound, it's adequately financed, the requirements are reasonable, and so on, then we hand it over to the program manager to execute that plan. And that's his job. And I think that we muddy that by having too much staff supervision between major milestones.
Part of the issue here is culture change, sir, and part of it's accountability. Mm-hmm. You're talking about some pretty radical changes. How do you bake these in so that when you're gone, they're still there, and this isn't a case of, well, we'll just keep doing it the way that we're doing it because Frank Kendall won't be here forever?
Well, Frank Kendall hopes to be here for a while yet. And I think that's a very good point, because the history of my office has been that leadership rotates about every 2 years. And people rotate in the services fairly often as well. We're trying to extend the period of our program managers stay in place. One change I put into 5002 for program managers was that they should come in a few months before a major milestone. So they have ownership of the plan that's approved. But then they should stay for a few years afterwards. So they also have responsibility for execution of the plan that they took through the approval process. In the past, we've done it the other way around. We've had program managers who tended to come in and be given a program with a plan they didn't generate, be responsible for trying to execute that plan for a few years, and then the kind of the keynote of their tenure is the next milestone decision, so getting a plan approved but not being responsible actually delivering to that plan. I'm trying to turn that around. I'm also trying to extend the period of time that program managers stay in their roles.
The effort to do that requires you to do what internally? Is this something that you can do arbitrarily? Do you need to work with some of your colleagues in the C-suite there, or how will that work?
It's primarily done through the service acquisition executives and through the personnel systems, if you will, in the services, who control the rotation times, et cetera. Now, for the civilians, it's a bit easier. For the military people, there are a number of things that affect when they change positions. There's a standard kind of rotational cycle. The war has made this harder, actually, because a lot of our people have been going out to do deployments. And so that makes it hard to keep them in position. Yeah, with the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan winding down, I think we'll be able to do better at that, though.
You have assigned Andrew Hunter the job of building some legislation suggestions to simplify the body of law that we talked about earlier. What will he do, and what is his timeline for producing something for you and for Congress?
Andrew is a former Hill staffer, so he's been on both sides of this. He's been in the Pentagon for a while now. I think he may be responsible for some of the laws that I'm trying to simplify, so it seems suitable to have him do this. Andrew's got the task to put together a team, which will be, across the department, basically, and to come back with a legislative proposal that we could submit for next fall. And we'll be working closely with the Congress on this. There's some efforts that are, we'd like to be closely allied with on the Hill to do some acquisition reform in the next cycle. And hopefully we can do this together. I think there's a huge potential here for us to make some progress and do something that will benefit everyone.
Connect the dots for me, please, between open systems architecture and better buying power. I've spoken to a number of folks. Nick Girton at Navy comes to mind about open mm-hmm. systems architecture. But connect those for me, please.
Nick's been a terrific leader in this area for us. The competition is the most effective way I know to get costs down. And many times we can't have competition for full up weapon systems, but what we can do is design our systems so that we can compete for subsequent upgrades and for subsequent work after the initial contract is let and after the products are delivered. But you can't do that unless you have a way to break out those subsystems or those components and acquire them separately through a competition. That requires you acquire the intellectual property that allows you to do that. It also requires that you design, and an open modular design is intended to be one where you can easily upgrade, let's just say, a sensor package on a surveillance aircraft, for example, and insert a different one. So you have to own the data associated with that, the interfaces in particular. as well as some of the information about how the data is moved between that system and other systems on the platform. But you have to be smart about that up front. You have to be smart about acquiring that information and getting rights to that information fairly early in the process. So what we're trying to make our people understand, or get our people to better understand, is how intellectual property laws actually work, what rights the government has and doesn't have, and how to work with industry to make sure we get the rights that we need at the best time for us to get them, and then take delivery of them so that we can implement open systems. And it is a central part of how we're going to continue competition after the initial acquisition.
You and Dr. Carter, Secretary Hagel, General Dempsey, the Joint Chiefs have all spoken pretty eloquently and pretty adamantly about the effects of the budget impasse. Now that we have a deal, I know that we are still learning and will learn in the coming weeks specifically how it will impact your agency. But do you find a silver lining in all of this, that at least you have some sense of top lines at this point, and that you have some understanding of where you might be able to go for the rest of this fiscal year and for 15?
We still have a ways to go. I think that the deal that was just struck does provide some progress for us. It's important, particularly in 14, because we get some significant relief from the sequestration cuts that we're about, that we're really in the process of implementing in 14. 15, we don't get as much relief. I don't know how 15 will come out at the end of the day. There's several problems with the sequestration level of cuts that we were expected to take. So near-term relief is helpful, but what we really need is a long-term planning target that is clear and that we can design our forces around and design the entire department around, basically, and work to get from where we are today to that target. So the lack of certainty is still a major problem for us about what's going to happen in the out years. The other problem is that these are still deep cuts. And even with the relief in 14 and 15, we still have what we identified in the Strategic Choices Management Review last spring as sort of a triangle of unfunded area in there that is going to be very, very difficult for the department to get through. So the relief we're getting is very helpful. We're very happy to have it. But we've still got a really big problem to work with here. And it's a combination of the level of cuts, the uncertainty, and the fact that we still have what is not really a very graceful ramp to get from here to wherever we're going to end up with in the future.